I want you also to understand why I love this picture to represent quantum gravity. So what is quantum gravity? If you have to tell in a sentence what is quantum gravity, is the discovery that there is a minimal size in nature. In the same way in which we have a minimal packet of energy in quantum mechanics, quantum gravity is the discovery that there is a minimal size that appears quite naturally if you combine what we know from quantum mechanics and general relativity. So quantum mechanics tells you that the more you want to probe reality on the small scale, so if you have a particle and you want to localize it, you need more and more energy. But then we know from general relativity that if you squeeze energy, and energy and mass are equivalent after special relativity, so if you squeeze a lot of energy in a small space, well, you form a black hole, and you cannot probe what is inside the black hole. So you try to probe things in the smaller and the smaller, but then at a certain point you form the black hole, so you cannot probe what is inside that. So you see that this is combining physics from quantum mechanics, and the characteristic quantity that appears in quantum mechanics is h-bar. We combine together general relativity. So in the radius of a black hole, we have a Newton's constant g that appears. And if you combine these two quantities, h-bar and g, you get a new quantity that is an area. It's called a Planck area. So maybe it's more familiar to talk about length, even though the area, in a certain sense, play even a more fundamental role. And you see, this gives you a length. So you take the square root of this quantity, h bar g, the fundamental Planck area, and you get a length that is minus 10 to the minus 35 meters. So how crazy is this size? If you think of quantum mechanics, the typical quantum mechanical phenomena are with atoms, the nucleus. So inside the nucleus, you have protons, and these protons have the size of a Fermi. A Fermi is 10 to the minus 15 meters. So think of of course, you don't perceive atoms. You don't perceive the particles inside the atoms, like the proton. And so we are talking about 10 to the minus 15th order of magnitudes. And then to go to 10 to the minus 35, it means that a proton have even less knowledge.
We're trying to open these pens. She went to art school. She knows how to do it.
So imagine you were a proton and you want to know how does it feel for a proton to live in a quantum space-time. Well, a proton have even less clue than you have about the proton, right? So this is the kind of crazy things we think about for our work. We even get paid to think about these things. And before you stop me, you stop thinking of what I'm saying because, well, this is too crazy. And of course, we don't have an access to the Planck scale. Okay, is this true? Yes, we don't have direct access to the Planck scale. But is it possible to make measurements, concrete measurements, such that we collect information about the Planck scale? And actually, the answer is yes. And we got a lot of information about this. Look at this. So it's not little information. So we have done a very long way. So for instance, we know that there are no supersymmetric particles. There are no violations of Lorentz invariants, at least with something like 16 figures. we know that we don't form black holes at CERN, for instance. So we know a bunch of things. We have been able to probe Planck scale physics, and there could be experiments that are at reach nowadays. So by the end of my talk, I want to talk about some new experiments that are coming up. And this is exactly where quantum gravity is meeting the quantum foundations, the working quantum foundation. Okay, but again, let's try to define what we talk about. So if you have to explain to the lay audience what is quantum physics, well, I would characterize it with the two aspects. The one is this discreteness. Quantum physics is about the fact that reality is discrete. It comes in a bunch of things, bunch of, of energy, and this bunch of energy is characterized by this quantity H bar. So discreteness is the first characteristic, and then you have a superposition, hence the Schrödinger cat, like the cat here that you see. I put it to, not just because I like cats, but because it represents quantum superpositions. Discreteness and superposition are, in a sense, two faces of the same medal, of the same coin. You know about particle wave dualities. So in a sense, it's embodied in the quantum theory, the fact that you have discreteness and superpositions together in the quantum theory. Yeah. So then, you're a physicist, you are interested in the mathematical description of this theory. What are the mathematical ingredients that you need to put there in order to define which kind of quantum theory you're talking about? We define this in terms of a triplet. We call this a spectral triple. So you need to give three things to define what you're talking about. The first thing is you have to tell what are the states of your theory. So this is what is embodied in the Hilbert space, if you're familiar with quantum mechanics. So you need to tell what are the states. You need to tell what are the physical theories you want to talk about, because the same Hilbert space can represent states that correspond to different physical things. And so this is where it comes, this A, that is the algebra of observables. So the observables are the physical quantities that your theory talk about. And then you need to give a principle, a dynamical principle that could be a Hamiltonian or could be given in terms of transition amplitudes. So transition amplitudes is it's the quantity that tells you how to compute probabilities. So given a state of the theory, you want to know what is the probability to have another state of the theory. So you wanted to define these three ingredients in your theory, and let me give you an example of this that you may have seen. So in standard electrodynamics, we have the electromagnetic field, but then we know that the electromagnetic field has a discrete nature. It's made of photons, right? And these photons, I can write states for them, and these states are what we call the Fock space. In this space, we can compute things. We can compute physical quantities that correspond to create or annihilate particles. So the operators, the observables, are every time that you act on these states and you create or you destroy particles. And then there is a dynamics, and the dynamics is encoded in transition amplitudes that are described by the so-called Feynman rules. So we write some graphs. It's a very nice way to compute things because you make little drawings, and from the drawings, you can associate to each part of the drawing a rule to put an element into computation. So graphical calculus is great, but graphical calculus has something more than just being a convenient way to compute things. And you will see how this happens in quantum gravity. So, okay, so we just said now we want to do the same thing for gravity. So in order to define a quantum theory of gravity, we need to describe what are the physical states, what are the observable quantities, and what is the dynamics of the theory. And now you see that basically what I want to do is to define a Schrödinger cat, but a Schrödinger cat of space-time, of geometry. So I represent the geometry with some geometrical quantities like triangles. And we said that there is a fundamental discreteness that now is not just h-bar, but is g, h-bar, is this fundamental area. And we want to see how geometries can be in superpositions. hence the triangulated cat. So here we go. We will have states in quantum gravity, we'll have observables, we will have transition amplitudes. But notice in this picture that while before I had the electromagnetic fields that lives on some space, and then of course I do the quantization, I see that there are particles, photons that lives in some space and in some time. In the case of quantum gravity, is space-time itself that gets quantized. So it's the very fabric of space and time that becomes made of particles, of quanta. And of course, then I can summarize this in a t-shirt. So now you know the first line is my Hilbert space of the theory. The second line is about the algebra observables. And the third line is about how to compute probabilities to go from one state of the quantum geometry to another state of the quantum geometry. So one question you may ask at this point is, what is space here? So we are talking about quantum space. And there is not space anymore in the sense that when we talk about space, what we need to give are relations about who is adjacent to who. So if you wanted to say, what is my position in this room? Well, I am next to the podium or next to the blackboard. I don't know. If I have to say, where are you sitting? You're sitting next to the entrance, and so on. So I don't need to talk about an abstract, absolute Newtonian space. I can talk about space just in terms of relations. So it's a weaker sense than the classical Newtonian space. And I can talk about space in terms of geometries. Geometry is what we measure concretely in terms of rods and clocks, because it's a four-dimensional space-time geometry. In the moment in which you have quantum discreteness for space and time, of course, you don't have any more a continuous Riemannian geometry, but still you have a notion of space. And there is not anymore this notion of a space that contains things, that is static, is absolute. And now, space-time itself it's a dynamical quantity. So what we have now is that instead of having this rigid box in which you have your quantum fields, we have all the quantum fields of matter that lives theirself on another quantum field. And as you know, in modern physics, we represent all the different fields in terms of, we characterize them in terms of their symmetries. So if you want, the gravitational field is one of the many fields that we have in nature at the fundamental level, and is characterized by a symmetry that is the Lorentz symmetry. So let me tell you something more about what is this field. Of course, it's a field that is slightly special with respect to the other. First of all, so the fields that you may have met, even if you haven't studied physics, but you may know that. So if I want to describe a field, what I do is that I take my space, and in each point of space, I associate a quantity. For instance, in this room, there is a field associated with the temperature. In each point in this room, I can associate one value of the temperature. Or for fields like the electromagnetic one, in each point, I associate a vector, like I'm doing in this figure. In the case of the gravitational field, there is something a bit slightly more difficult, because in each point I associate an entuplet of vectors. And these are the reference frames. So in order to localize things, in order to describe motion, we need the reference frames. Yeah.
The entuplet, the n is the number of vectors.
So yes, it's you need at least four in four-dimensional space-time, but for a reason, I'm talking about generic entuplet, not because I wanted to go to higher dimensions, but because you will see in the formulation of the theory, you can also have entuplet. What you need is that, so to define a reference frame, you need these vectors to have the same origin as you as you can see there. So this condition corresponds to the fact that you want that the sum of these vectors gives you zero. And there is an amazing theorem from Minkowski in geometry, in standard geometry, that tells you that once you have a bunch of vectors that sum up to zero, you have automatically a polyhedron associated to that. So you, if you have four vectors, you can create a tetrahedron, but you can have also other stuff, like, for instance, you can have something like this, and you can. So once you have a number of vectors that comes up and sum up to zero, you have a unique classical polyhedra that is associated to that. And I was saying there is something special about the gravitational field, that is that, in fact, these reference frames that are promoted in general relativity to reference fields are not defined in space and in time, but they make up space and time themselves. So I have to remove the underlying surface that I was with which I was representing space and time. And they have something peculiar, that is that I can decide, I have a freedom to orient them as I want. So like I can rotate them, and so there is a rotational symmetry. And this is the rotational symmetry that is hidden inside the Lorentz symmetry of the theory. Sure, no, please ask questions while I'm speaking, of course.
Is that rotational symmetry what people mean when they say small dimensions in like string theory?
No, absolutely not. Okay. So the theory I'm constructing here is a theory that is four-dimensional to start with. So I'm starting from what I know about the world. Maybe there are more dimensions, but this is not an ingredient of my theory. I see the characteristics of space and time that I see in the world. I see that we see four dimensions. We see the presence of the Lorentz symmetry. So I am constructing a field theory. Well, it's not a field theory because it's discrete. It's more like a lattice gauge theory in which I start from these symmetries and this dimensionality, and with these ingredients, I write the theory. So what I want as a goal, that is a specific goal of loop quantum gravity, and other approaches to quantum gravity may have other agenda. But the agenda of loop quantum gravity, that is the theory I work on, is just to have a realization of a quantum theory in which I quantize the gravitational field. I want, as a minimal desiderata, to cure the infinities of general relativity, like the Big Bang or the singularity that you have in the center of the black hole. So these are pathologies of general relativity. I think of these infinities as a lack of predictability of the theory and not as a physical reality, let's say. So I wanted just to have a better mathematics, a better theory that tell me what happens when I reach those kind of densities, with those kinds of scales. And but yet I want the theory to give me back standard general relativity in the classical limit. That means when I take h bar to zero, when I remove the quantum discreteness given by the presence of h bar, I want to have general relativity back. And so the theory is doing this for me. And I don't have anything to say new about the other matter fields, so I'm just taking the standard model as it is, and I am coupling it with this theory. So the result is that I can model my quantum space-time as a quantum geometry in terms of some polyhedra. But of course, this will be fuzzy polyhedra because they can be in a superposition. They have a quantum nature. And I wanted to have a notion of adjacency. So I wanted to know which quanta is in interaction with the other. In fact, the notion of location, it just means who is interacting with whom, okay? And I do this by introducing a graph. So the graph is just a convenient structure to tell which interactions I am considering between the quanta. So the result is a bunch of quantum polyhedra in interaction with one another that creates the states in my theory. Yep.
We've gone away from space-time, but would it be a graph living in, because that's a 2D graph.
Yes.
Is it on a 2D plane? Would it be in four dimensions?
So the graph is representing, that's a beautiful question, and it gets beautifully realized in the theory. So for the moment, you can think of the graph as living, just think about space for the moment, because it's more convenient, it's easier to visualize. So think of those, especially if you wanted to compute a state of the geometry, namely, I measure the gravitational field here, and then I wait, I measure the gravitational field again, I want to know the probability from one measurement to the other measurement, right? So I am like removing time, I am choosing a time, and I choose initial time and a final time. So what I need to do this is just a state that capture the three-dimensional space. So for the moment, even if the theory is completely covariant with respect to this, but for visualizing, for understanding what is going on, you can think about these states as being three-dimensional geometries of space. And I will tell you in a moment what gives you the dynamics, what gives you the evolution. But at this point, so it's quantum, it's gravity, where are the loops, right? Everybody asks always, what are the loops in this theory, okay? And this is quite simple. So in gravity, in general relativity, we discovered that this space in which we live may have curvature. And a measure of the gravitational fields corresponds to, say, how much curvature there is. But how do we measure curvature in general? We can do it in the following way. So, like, you take a pointer, a vector, a little arrow, and you parallel transport it. So you don't change the direction. Like, say, this is an arrow. So imagine I have some path from here to here, and I take an arrow here, and I want to parallel transport it, you say, without changing the direction. So I do this in flat space, and of course, I get back to the original point, and I can compare the original vector at the beginning with the vector that I have in the end, and they are just the same, they point in the same direction. But if I try to do this in a curved space, for instance, on the surface of the Earth, you start from the North Pole, and then you go down to the equator, you move along the equator, and then you come back, you see that I started in this way, and when I'm back in this other direction. And there is a direct relation between the angle between these two positions and how much curvature it's contained in the surface inside the path, inside this closed loop. So there is an analogy here with what happens with electromagnetism. For instance, in electromagnetism, you have the Faraday lines. And if you take a certain surface, and you look at how many Faraday lines are puncturing this surface, the more punctures, the more lines, the stronger is your electromagnetic field. And with gravity, it's the same. You can think of doing loops. So in this case, I go back. I have a lighter field. So I have just this angle. You can see, yes, this angle here. I do it here with more Faraday lines of the gravitational field. And I will see a wider angle. OK. So I need to make a path and come back to compare these arrows. This comparison, well, technically, this is because I want a gauge invariance in my theory. I wanted to preserve a gauge invariance. So for those who knows this. But the point is that I have to come back and compare the two arrows to make a meaningful measurement of how strong is the field, how much curvature I have, hence the loops. And again, for those who knows, just to remember this, these are just Wilson lines. So if you need to remember why the loops, Wilson lines, Wilson loops. Okay, so the remaining piece to understand this picture, so we have these states. The kind of physical quantities we measure are geometrical quantities like area, volumes, angles, curvature, and so on. And then the remaining piece to understand are these probabilities, so the probabilities to go from one state to another. And okay, so this is a bad slide, so not very good communications to many equations, but the point is that take a state of the theory given by a graph like this. In fact, let me just take a very simple graph. And I wanted to go from one state to another state. And what I do is basically, for instance, I can have a quantum of space, and then I have a vertex amplitudes from which I create more quantum space. So the transition is from a graph that represents the presence of one quanta to a graph that represents a presence of three quanta here. Let me go back. You see that there are rules that are just like the Feynman rules. But instead of having planar graphs, you have like a three-dimensional thing in which you have bubbles and chambers. So we talk about spin form in this case. Spin because it's quantum, and a form because you see you have these surfaces, chambers that looks like, And so this is a visualization of what happens at the fundamental level in which you have quantas that are created and annihilated, and this is what should make up space-time. Okay, so let me tell you about a couple of applications. And first of all, I wanted to tell you that quantum gravity, again, is not just about going and doing going with a hammer, let's say, and going directly to probe the deep quantum regime of the Planck scale, in which we go to a site that is 10 to the minus 35 meters. So we can do something a bit smarter, and we may be able to see quantum gravity in our labs. Yeah?
So how much above the Planck scale do you have to go before you start to see something that looks like regular GR and regular 4D spacetime?
Okay, so concretely, so I don't know how to answer this question in terms of, I just said like a length of the 10 to the minus 35 meters. I don't have an answer like, I go to 10 to the minus, 27 meters, and then, so it's a bit more subtle. So first of all, yes, we do have some control of these limits. We know that the theory I'm talking about gives you back generativity. Usually the convergence is quite rapid. So I don't know if I can talk in terms of spin, for instance. So what happens is that you have your theory in which you have states that are characterized by a certain spin. And typically in quantum mechanics, like with angular momentum, if you have a spin 1/2, you are in a deep quantum regime. But when you start to be at a spin that is higher and higher, your system starts to behave as a classical system. So we have some simulations in which the spins that appears in the theory, when you reach something like 4 or 10, already manifest a behavior that is like a classical behavior. But it's a bit more subtle. I cannot just tell you, I take a bunch of space like this, and this is classical. The other thing to be careful about is that the meaningful quantity here is the energy density. So we don't want to, so I'm jumping on something that I wanted to talk in a couple of slides. But let me tell you, no, but let me tell you this because it's important. So in the Einstein equation, you have the geometry that is equal to an energy density. So we should focus on the energy density to know when we are in the deep quantum regime. And to be in the deep quantum regime, you will have a Planckian energy density. So when you are half of the Planckian energy density, you're still in a quantum regime. So you should go, I think, at least a few order of magnitudes higher, I mean, or lower in energy to get out. So but let me go back to this question, because I want to talk about cosmology, and this is a good example exactly to talk about this. So I just want to conclude with four examples of how you can do quantum gravity. And I wanted to start with low energy quantum gravity that makes a very interesting connection with the ongoing research in the quantum foundations and quantum information. So the first thing is that we said that gravity is about reference frames. And reference frames concretely are embodied in material systems. I was talking about rods and clocks. So rods and clocks are really like atoms that, or harmonic oscillators in the form of an atom that are giving you the pace at which things happen, and so on. Doing experiments with quantum mechanics, we are reaching a regime in which standard classical clocks are not enough anymore to describe what is going on, and we may need, for real, quantum clocks to describe the evolution of the system. Except that if in the moment in which you started to think in terms of quantum clocks and quantum rods, well, you are already doing a quantum gravity in a sense. And in particular, this can lead to a superposition of your reference frames. And the superposition of reference frames can give very funny effects, like reference frames decide for you what is the causal structure of your theory, namely what are the sequence of events that you're going to see. But if you're in a superposition of reference frames, in one reference frame you can have a certain sequence of events, and in another reference frame you can have another sequence of events. And this is something we can already see in the labs in principle, and we need to understand better how the laws of physics are compatible with these quantum reference frames. So we know that the laws of physics should be invariant with respect to changes in reference frames. But what if the reference frames are quantum? We should have new ways to understand the transformations. So this is a very active line of research in quantum information. And so research in quantum foundations is pushing more and more probing quantum mechanics. So this is just, it's very funny because we are talking about hypes, and of course sometimes you see, oh, new cool experiments that just confirmed quantum mechanics. Nevertheless, there is a technological advancement, and we can do indeed cool things with those advancements. So we can probe superpositions of physical systems up to systems that could have a weight that is 20 grams. That's a lot. So in the past, I remember you could put in superposition something like a virus or a molecule. 20 grams is a lot. It's really a lot. So it's already massive. It has a sizable gravitational field, something that is 20 grams, right? And we can put in superposition things that are distant, that are far away from one another. So this is a half of a meter. I can have something that is in superposition, two particles, a particle that is in superposition, and it could be as far away as half of a meter. So this is amazing. And I was saying, so in the moment in which you have something like this, you can start to think, what about the gravitational field generated by this quantum system? So a mass, an energy density determines how geometry curve. So if I have something that is 20 grams, but is in a superposition, it means also that I am like creating two different gravitational fields. So like a gravitational field that have a bump here and a gravitational field that instead a bump here, and those are in a superposition. So you see that in the lab, in a sense, we are already creating quantum gravity. And there is something very interesting that could happen when you put in superposition not just a single particle, but you have two particles that are split, like in this example. So you take a particle, you split it, like with two slits, and then you recompose it. And you can do the same with another particle, with two particles that are not connected. They don't have any entanglement to start with. You can prepare the system with these two particles that don't know of one another. But then you see you have two possibilities. One possibility in which the two particles goes this way, one possibility in which the particle goes this way, possibility in which the particle goes this way, and a possibility in which the particle gets closer to one another, sufficiently close to feel the gravitational field of each other. So this means that in one of these channels, the particles are interacting through gravitation. And there are currents, people trying to develop an experiment, because if then you measure the two particles, the two outgoing particles, that have entanglement, even if you prepare them without any entanglement, it means that this entanglement has been developed because an interaction has been going on, and the only interactions in this experiment is a gravitational interaction. But then there is a theorem that tells you that if you wanted to have the development of entanglement, the interaction that has developed it needs to be a quantum interaction. So if in the next 5 years they will be able to make these experiments and see the entanglement, it would be a confirmation that the gravitational field is a quantum field. Sorry, there was...
Can you go back to the slide before?
Yep.
25 kilodaltons isn't 20 grams. It's nowhere near 20 grams, right?
Okay. I was trusting, I was trusting a presentation from my colleagues in quantum information on this, so I don't know the details of what is going on in this.
I think that's a tiny, tiny amount of grams. I think it's 25 times 10 to the 3 over 6 times 10 to the minus 20, 6 times 10 to the 20.
Okay, I have to check this because I admit I didn't go to the actual article to check this information. I was relying on the information given to me by my colleagues that are working on these experiments. So you may be totally right. So in every case, the point is that you can put in superposition a sizable amount of matter. How much is it? Okay, don't trust this. Don't trust this.
4 × 10⁻².
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's big compared to proton, right? But it's...
Okay. Thank you for checking this.
20 grams is just huge.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got a bad... I was taking this from a slide of a colleague. A bad idea. Okay, you have to check yourself. Okay. Nevertheless, the point stays. We are with experiments in the lab at reach of probing superpositions of geometries and probing the quantum nature of space-time. This is not yet checking which theory of quantum gravity is the right one. The fact that you should have a superposition of geometries is a generic prediction of quantum gravity that stays within different proposals. But it's killing, for instance, the ideas of all the people that say quantum gravity should not be quantized at all. So, and this is something that we may be able to see in the next 10 years, maybe 5-10 years. We are already very close. Okay, let me just say a couple of things about the very high energy. Very high energy corresponds, for instance, to what happens at the center of black holes. I told you that quantum gravity cures the singularities of general relativity. So instead of having a singularity, when you have a collapse, you form a black hole in the center, you have something else that happens that takes the form of a bounce, like matter is getting more and more compressed in a very small space. But of course, you can have a volume that is smaller than a Planck volume, and you can have a density that is higher than the Planckian energy density. So at a certain point, the only thing that you can do is just to have the opposite process from a contraction going into an expansion. So basically, this corresponds to a white hole, and there could be some interesting phenomenology going on associated with that. And nice thing, by the way, you cure all the information paradoxes. Another thing that come out of this is the fact that even after this bounce, even after, so say your black hole evaporates, gets very small, in the moment in which it's small, it's more likely, it's more probable that you have this bouncing effect, that you turn your black hole into a white hole, well, then you still have something that remains there, is what we call a remnant. You have an object that is like a Planck size particle, but with a very, very large interior that has been created through the history of the black hole, with a small throat. And this small throat, in fact, can be even a superposition of a black and white geometry. And because of the presence of a minimal area, this throat cannot shrink to zero directly, because this would be a quantum jump. It's similar to what happens with atoms, so that you don't have the collapse of the electrons inside the nucleus. Here, this object is stay open because you have a minimal area.
Yeah, this has been a lot of really interesting ideas through this talk so far, but I'm just wondering, how might you go about explaining these ideas to people who don't have a background in physics?
The white holes one, or everything?
Everything or this?
I don't know. I explain. I just do it. I take maybe more than 1 hour to do so. I was trusting your ability to absorb more things. By the way, this is a good moment to stop. So let me just, so the other things that I wanted to tell you was about the bouncing universe. It's the same idea as the black hole one. So you can have a bouncing cosmology. And the research that I'm doing these days is about understanding the primordial quantum fluctuations. Understanding the primordial quantum fluctuations directly from the theory of quantum gravity. So like the other days, we were learning about inflation and the idea that you can have quantum fluctuations of space-time at the beginning that are stretched, and they give rise to all the structure that we see in the universe. There is a caveat there that the states, the initial states that you used is an ad hoc state to fit with inflation. And what I'm trying to do is to try to predict from quantum gravity what should be this state. And that's the end of my talk. I wanted to address your question. How do you explain these things to the lay audience? Well, I did it. I was teaching to high school students. A full course on general relativity, and I was teaching. I have just finished my course on the origin of the universe for general students, and the steps that goes into explaining these things is first of all trying to make them. And of course, you cannot understand quantum gravity unless you understand a bit of quantum mechanics in the flavors with which I was telling you these things. So I was stressing discreteness, I was stressing superposition. For general relativity, I was stressing the notion of reference frames, how geometry comes into this game. So the point is that you should do this step by step. I don't know if I can say this. Carlo, can I tell? There was a time many years ago in which I really want Carlo to tell to the public about quantum gravity. And I was insisting, like, he had the possibility to write for a newspaper. And I was saying, you should tell about loop quantum gravity. You should tell about loop quantum gravity. You should tell about the things, the cool things we are doing. I say, oh, no, but I cannot explain loop quantum gravity to everybody. They should know about general relativity. They should know about quantum mechanics. How do I do? And I said, well, you write an article about quantum mechanics, you write an article about general relativity, and then you write an article about loop quantum gravity. And he did it. And these are the three first lessons of the brief seven lessons of physics. So yeah, I mean, maybe you need more than one article, maybe you need more than 1 hour, but you can break this into pieces. And for me, a lot of the thing is about explaining general relativity and explaining quantum mechanics in a way that is already compatible with what we are doing. And then this brings me to another point with my final point. My final point is that we are doing a very tough job that is about constructing new physics. And of course, we would like to have the guidance of experiments, but sometimes experiments are not available to you. And also in the history of physics, it's not that revolutions have come always from experiments. In the case of Copernicus and Kepler, there were no new experiments. They were using exactly the same data. They were using the Ptolemaic tables. But they were rearranging them, conceptualizing things in a way that suddenly look at more clear, more reasonable. And here we are trying to do something similar, and that's why we need the foundations of physics. We need philosophers to talk with, because what a philosopher does is exactly a work of cleaning. So here in this picture, I am putting a word that is used by philosopher. What is dispensable in your theory? What are the things, the mathematical structure that we are using because of historical convenience and we can get rid of because they started to be a heavy baggage for us? So I think that in the moment in which we start to think about quantum mechanics and general relativity, cleaning up what is not necessary and looking at the core of the theory, then we see the similarities between general relativity and quantum mechanics. And we have a chance to make this bridge with a new theory. And I think that the same thing could happen also in the communication. In the moment in which you start to present things, of course, the historical development is interesting, but you can also try to present in a modern way and evaluate different presentations according to how they fit with all the other things that we know. For instance, different interpretations of quantum mechanics, how do you evaluate them? Because they all describe the same experiments, the same outcome. You evaluate them, for instance, for how far they can lead you to new understanding, whether they are compatible, for instance, with quantum field theory, with a relativistic extension of quantum mechanics. Give you an example. You take Bohmian mechanics, beautiful, conceptually clear, but then you cannot make it relativistic. So what I'm saying is that let's try to take the core of the theories, tell what we know, what is compatible with all the other physics that we know, and then things follow nicely. Questions?
Do you work much with people who are doing experiments, or not at all?
Sorry?
Do you work much with people who are doing experiments?
So these experiments that I was talking about in quantum information, The people who are doing that are part of a collaboration that is called KISS, so you can check this out. We have also very nice YouTube channels with talks, and it's a collaboration that has been going on for 4 years. We have 2 more years of fundings, and hopefully also we can go on later. But yes, if you wanted to know more about these things, there are some resources on the website. And since I was mentioning philosophy, I want also to highlight my philosophy home, and that is the Rotman Institute of Philosophy, of course.
So I have a question about the white holes, and you're talking about the geometry that happens there. Is that where does that geometry go with relation to the rest of, you know, suppose you have just flat space and there's a black hole, and you say there's a white hole that's kind of coming out the other side. Is that like a finger of geometry that's off in its own direction?
No, you're saying on the other side. Yeah. There is no other side. So the idea is that, we have some space here. You have a mass that is like puncturing space-time here. It's like creating, digging. So there is a mass that is puncturing my space-time. And then it gets released and reabsorbed in the fabric of the universe in the same point. So this is a process in time. Yep. It's not a process that takes you to another point in space. Is this the question? Was this the question?
Yeah, I'm still trying to understand.
Well, the confusing part is that physicists for years have been going on saying, you go inside a black hole, then you have a wormhole that takes you somewhere else. And it's a recent development, the fact that you can write a metric, a full metric, in which everything happens in the same place without having to go in another universe or in another area of space. And this for me was a breakthrough, because you can also have a phenomenology in this way, because if this bouncing happens within our own universe, then you may have particles coming out, you can see cosmic rays maybe coming out from this phenomenon in our universe and not somewhere else. And that's it. there is another cool stuff. Sorry, I cannot resist to say that. So it's a process in space, but because of time dilatation and with general relativity, so if you are an observer from outside, this process will take billions of years to happen. But if you are the matter that is collapsing, going inside, forming the black hole, going inside and coming out, it just takes a few milliseconds for you, for your moving clock. So if you have a black hole that formed in the early universe, say, by direct collapse of photons, you have like a time machine that takes these early photons and brings them back to us now. And for them, there is no time to do thermal messy things, because it's just a millisecond. They just go inside and they go out. But for us, it's billions of years. And I think this is beautiful. It's a marvelous time machine.
And what's the name of that metric? Eh? What's the name of that metric?
Soltani, Rovelli, and Hahn metric. It was published like two weeks ago. There was a first metric. People have tried to construct this kind of metrics since the 70s. Long story. So of course people have tried. There were technical difficulties. There have been some recent advancements, but that's the tricky thing. So if you just look at the conformal diagrams, you see the white holes in the conformal diagrams that is disconnect. But there are ways in which you can cure this.
Thank you for the talk. I'm not going to pretend like I understood everything.
Maybe I should have attended all the session.
I mean, it's a really difficult subject, but I got further the last time I tried to learn about quantum gravity, so I consider it a win.
Thank you.
But I wanted to just ask, so I really liked the analogy to thinking about like when you started with like the electromagnetic field and how it gets quantized, and those quanta are photons, and then kind of extending that analogy into thinking about like space-time as a fabric instead of like a container. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask, like, what's the quanta in that like analogy? Is that why people are searching for like the graviton? Is that what that is? Or
yeah, the graviton is a bit of a tricky.
Or does the analogy fail at that point? like space-time fabric, I still think of as continuous.
Yeah, no. It is space-time. The good analogy is really the T-shirt, in the sense that you see this as something very continuous, but then you look and there are threads. Yeah. Even though one should be careful with the gravitons, because the notion of gravitons comes with a perturbative theory. So it's like you have your field and that is in a given state, and then you have an excitation, you know, particles are excitation of your field. So this is true also in the case of gravity. But so you can choose a given geometry for your gravitational field, a given configuration, and then you can make a perturbation that is a graviton that propagates on this geometry. So there is a bit of distinction between these two things. So one. Well, I would call them, quantum space-time, but it's not. But the graviton, when people talk about graviton, usually is this other thing, the perturbation that could behave as a particle, like a particle propagates, but is like not.
So are there like efforts to like detect the quanta?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you cannot go, I mean, in principle, there is a very clear prediction that is, if you try to make a measurement of a volume of space, at a certain point you will see a discrete spectrum if you could go at sufficient high energy. So, but the thing is that we don't have access to these very high energies. So we have to be smart and see for cumulative effects. So it's only in the moment in which you don't look at this effect of the presence of a single quanta, but like you take into account, for instance, if you have a very long time scales or very large collective behaviors, like in the case of black hole, then you can have places in which you see the.
Look for effects that can only be described by like a quantized.
Sorry?
Phenomena that can only be described by
quantum. Yeah. So on one hand, we have these experiments in the lab, but otherwise, the most promising places to look for quantum gravity are, of course, the early universe. So with the bouncing cosmologies, the bounce is a phenomenon that comes from the presence of this quantum discreteness. And so there are predictions for the CMB, for the cosmological perturbations, about what you should see if there was a bounce, for instance, or for black holes, when you do black holes physics and you assume that there is no singularity there. Or also, if you assume that the horizon of the black hole is in fact composed by a lot of, like a tessellation of the space due to these elementary discrete areas, then you may have effects that could be visible.
All right, well, we've got to wrap up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.